Hello, this is Patrick Stewart talking to Tom Fitzgerald about the Worm Ouroboros. If you've clicked this, you probably know who I am. Patrick Stewart, not the actor, the RPG writer from the False Machine blog and a few books. Tom, could you introduce yourself to anyone who's not familiar with you?
Hello, I'm Tom Fitzgerald from Australia, and I occasionally write the Midmerk blog.
Right, and you're currently working on a book of monsters, I think, which we can see evidence of on the blog. Yeah, a classic.
Yes, absolutely.
Classic old school RPG blog. Okay. Today we got together for the this is our second attempt because the first one failed because of Windows audio management and my stupidity. But this is our second attempt to talk about the Worm Ouroboros, which is a book written sometime in the 1920s by A.R. Edison. For anyone who's not familiar with it, I'll give you a brief description of what it is. It is a kind of starts off as a kind of dream vision in which a guy from I think Cumbria sits down in a magical bed and goes on a journey to Mercury, guided by a spirit guide, and is introduced to this remarkable court full of incredible beings. And then it slowly transforms into a kind of War of the Roses, Iliad, kind of warring family situation in which these two groups, one the Demonlanders and the other the Witchlanders, go to war against each other for complex feudal and personal psychological reasons. And the King of the Witchlanders unleashes his magic, which consists of the Worm Ouroboros, I think, itself. And then the Demonlanders, who are nominal heroes, go on a quest to recover their lost sibling. And then finally, there is a final confrontation and a remarkable and rather strange ending. The whole thing gradually turns from being about Mercury into being this tiny pocket world of fantastic landscapes and strange beings. That's basically what it is. Tom, do you have anything to add to that?
Do I have anything to add? Well, yes. The idea that it is Mercury is a very curious idea that is in among many that are initially introduced by Edison, but sort of later on discarded. Essentially, after the first quarter of the book, no need to mention Mercury anymore, because the nature of this book is that Edison appears to become infatuated with the story of the demons and the witches and all the other beings in this world, who are essentially people, and forgets some of the devices he uses to introduce the story and the world, but doesn't feel the need to go back and edit those devices out. It's one of the characteristics of it that there are some inconsistencies that remain but do not detract from the beauty of the book.
Right. And people here seem to worship or at least recognize a pantheon of gods not dissimilar to the Greek or Norse pantheon. I don't think they're very specifically named, but this pantheon doesn't do much, has particular agents who have sacred power, and does one big thing at the end without revealing themselves, and is generally agreed to be the real gods. And there is one moment, I think, where a individual from a less privileged group talks about their gods, and the main characters, who are all pantheists or polytheists, laugh ridiculously at him for believing in ridiculous savage mumbo-jumbo.
Absolutely.
It's very much a book of the 1920s, and it's questionable racial coding. Anyone familiar with RPGs? Even though these people are all people, the one element of their inhumanity that does seem to go out through the book is that there are weird cultural power levels. The Demonlanders start off with horns. One of them breathes fire. That's quickly forgotten. They have their own aesthetic, but the boss Demonlanders, and if you're familiar with RPGs, seem to be of a higher level than everybody else. They can take on large groups of people. And then below them are the Witchlanders, who are considered to be almost as good, but not quite. And they have their own character. And they can beat up most people, but not the Demonlanders one-on-one, apart from one or two of their most potent characters. And then things gradually step down, I think. There are goblins who are considered to be like, I'm not sure how we would code them in our world, but they are
They're kind of medium. They're medium, but they're certainly not up to the witches or the demons. Yeah. One of the really interesting things that I have noted about them is that there's a sort of slight variation in the nomenclature, that the witches and the demons, or the people of witchland and of demonland, are referred to as witches and demons. But when it comes to the others, occasionally Carinius calls Gro a goblin, but perhaps in an insulting way. But then the Pixielanders are never Pixies, they're Pixielanders, and the Implanders are never actually Imps. So it's a curious nomenclature that is almost certainly, there's certainly a holdover from the origin of this story. And the origin of this story comes from Edison's youth, Edison's childhood.
Yes. Tell us about Edison, Tom, because I think you know more about him than I do.
Well, Edison was, he was a civil servant and occasional author who was about 10 years older than Tolkien and was occasionally in social contact with Tolkien. You used the marvellous phrase in your review, in Tolkien's cognitive penumbra. And they certainly met one another a couple of times at the famous meetings of the Inklings.
Well, to enter it briefly, when I use cognitive penumbra, that's a particular phrase I use for someone who is difficult to deal with because they are that in that band of understanding where they're not so close to you that you understand them perfectly or that you share the same impulses, and they're not so far away from you that you can look upon their strangeness with diffidence and think, oh, well, they're an odd fellow or they're a strange person, but it doesn't affect very much. It's that particular range of comprehension where someone is enough like you that their actions, feelings, and beliefs can pull upon you and they feel similar to you, and so you feel engaged with them and drawn towards them, but they're different enough from you that they become very frustrating. It's that zone of frustration where someone is like yet unlike you, and it takes kind of maximal energy to deal with the challenge of comprehending them is kind of what I mean by cognitive penumbra.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The relationship between these two is intriguing. Edison's a few years older than Tolkien, but was also similarly involved in the kind of activity that medievalists at the time were engaged in, which was the translation of Icelandic sagas. This is one of the things that's essentially at the root of fantasy. I think that all of the authors who contributed to that first generation of what we would consider to be modern fantasy, which is this is right here, it's essentially starting from Edison, Dunsany's around the same time. All of those authors that preceded that, starting from I guess the 1860s or so, late Victorian kind of William Morris, various other people associated with that late Victorian medievalist movement were doing this thing where they were translating sagas, and essentially this is like that. This is like Edison having translated sagas, having been involved in reading sagas, contributing his own version of a saga that is essentially based on his it's not his role-playing campaign from his childhood, because role-playing games had not been invented yet. But Arthur Ransom, who is another author who was a friend of Edison when he was a child, recounts these stories of them playing with these exact same characters as little cardboard figures in a cardboard theatre, engaged in all kinds of feats of derring do and spouting marvellous soliloquies. So it's essentially...
Right.
Like Edison responding to this translation of sagas, this idea of the saga, using his own characters from his childhood to populate the saga. And there's an interesting element to which they're culturally a little bit ambiguous. They have elements of perhaps resembling Renaissance-era courtiers, having some of the characteristics of the characters from Viking sagas, and having paying lip service to the gods of the Greek pantheon.
There's an interesting synchronicity there between me and Edison, because when I was very young, I had a friend who was also really into Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yes.
And even though none of us knew what role-playing was, we would get together and play out scenes from like imaginary shows. And because he had a house... It gets better. He had a house with like a big window in it. And so one of us would stand up in the window and pull the curtains aside. And that would be the view screen for the Enterprise. And then we would propose like problems to the other person as like in very Picard-esque, like this needs to happen for this. And then we would like do like scenes even though, and this was before we knew what role playing was. So I grew up watching television and basically crossed over from watching television to kind of invisibly making my own sub show instinctively. And Anderson, I think, must have grown up watching theater and reading like whatever English schoolboys did in the early 20th century. And he crossed over as well with his friend to making their own small theater. And it's like, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, obviously, theater, especially, you know, Shakespearean, Marlowe, the theater of that era has a huge influence on it in terms of the language. And the language is very interesting. How would you characterize the language that Edison uses to write this book?
Okay, so I've characterized it as someone starting off to write kind of something a bit like Shakespeare or a bit like Marlowe or something later.
Yeah.
And then basically taking the rhythms and the basic concept of that and then thinking, oh, wait, there's this thing from Spenser I can put in. Oh, there's this thing from this other poet I can put in. Oh, wait, I can do this whole new thing. Oh, wait, I can use these new words that sound like they're old but are new. And basically taking the basic structure and growing it into this different thing, which is kind of half modern and just pulls from every single piece of poetry and every single piece of literature that they're familiar with and that they liked and kind of combines and recreates it into this thing, which is, I'd say it's Jacobean or pseudo Shakespearean. I think Shakespeare would have found it really disturbingly modern, at least in the phrases. It doesn't have perfect rhythm. It's not like in A Time to Hope, but it has like a very relaxed, that's perfect euphony. So it doesn't have complete structure in the same way poetry does, but every line sounds precise when it is sounded. And there are no lines out of place in the sounds. There are no clashing sounds, repeated words. There are no like vowels in the wrong place. I think we both came to this through reading it out loud or hearing it read out loud. And it's the structure of sound inside it comes very much from poetry and from theatre, even though it's a more relaxed kind of less systemically arranged. Or even Shakespearean stuff aren't really systemically arranged. They're kind of systemic for a bit, and then they'll break out of it, and then they'll come back into it. So it's kind of a flowing rhythm. But yeah, I would say that's kind of a long statement, but yeah, that's my definition of it.
Yeah, which brings me into another thing, the curious combination of original components and these elements borrowed from history, from especially that era of, you know, what early modern Renaissance era English poetry primarily.
And in a colonial, with the language of a colonial empire as well, because there's like Fax Fay Faz and other places, and the range of sounds of the places that are named in the world comes from, I think, all over the British Empire, I would suspect. And it's all these places you might have seen on a map that was colored pink as a schoolboy, of like, these are the Himalayas, you're on this bit over here, Kostra Pivracha, that's in a mountain somewhere, Mivash, this is a guy, Atenemos. So yeah, it's kind of like, it has a global sound, range of sound. The Prince Lafarese, where does that come from? Is that like,
there are phonemes that are essentially foreign phonemes, and especially Demonland itself, which has mainly English language names or very, very close to English. Everything's called Looking Haven Ness and Switchwater Way and Breaking Dale and all these.
I grew up in Cumbria and went past the Valley of Wastwater on the way to Whitehaven, past Egremont. This place sounds a lot like Cumbria to me, particularly the Lake District. Like the names sound really familiar.
That's very interesting. I once upon a time, having never been to Cumbria, I wrote up an Ars Magica campaign in Cumbria in on a mountain called Blencathra, which was near the village of Throkeld, quite close to Keswick. So I have a familiarity with the Lakes District from populating it with all kinds of little monsters and fairies and such like. But yeah, there is certainly a familiarity. The Demonland is many mountain Demonland. It's always given that formulation, which is part of the
theory. Oddly enough,
what's that?
The phrase black market comes from Keswick because it used to be one of the nation's only graphite mines, and graphite was really valuable, and so people would steal the graphite and sell it and smuggle it, and they would end up with black fingers, and I think that's where the phrase black market comes from. My apologies for breaking out the rumor of Buster's Brewery again.
But yeah, so there's this curious thing that is Edison is engaged in this curation of all these different elements. It's almost like if he was more of a purist as Tolkien is or was, he would not have borrowed things in quite the same way. But it's almost like he tried to achieve a certain feeling, tried to achieve a certain element, and just sampled, essentially, like in a much more postmodern kind of way, just sampled little elements from here and there that fit in the space, and the incongruence was not so important because of the atmosphere or the feeling or the sense, the emotion that they were able to evoke.
Yes, it is precisely true to A River of Feeling that runs through the entire book, and the world and the names can be pulled from whatever is not from wherever is necessary, but they can be pulled from a reasonable large palette in order to fit that feeling. I guess you define that as romantic, right? It's like we're in the middle of this emotion, there needs to be a place here, it needs to have the right sound, and so it needs to fit with the rest of these places. And so other than that, this song, this place, this name, this structure of speech can come from anywhere, as long as it's true to the emotion. Whereas in Tolkien, other way around, has to be a world first and a history and the pain. Like, there has to be, the language has to make sense. I don't think Tolkien could write a language that didn't make sense to him. It would be like needles in his skin. And so there has to be a world first, but there has to be emotion. And then you only have the real emotions from the world.
Yeah, Tolkien was notably very critical of C.S. Lewis for his essentially doing the same thing, selecting elements from Greco-Roman mythology and from Germanic mythologies and combining these in much the same way as contemporary fantasy does that with no issues. Tolkien had this sort of somewhat purist approach where he was trying to make it, internally consistent was one of his catchwords. He really wanted to achieve a degree of internal consistency. But internal consistency is not Edison's, it's not his focus. There is that beautiful phrase that is used in the introduction to the book, superhuman energy, which is essentially a really good way of capturing the gusto, the absolute gusto with which Edison attacks this thing. So part of, I think, all the little inconsistencies and all the little unusual characteristics that it has are just part of that process of he's in such a hurry, he has so much momentum in embarking upon this story that those things get taken along.
Yes, and as a writer, and anyone listening can take a drink every time I say that, I've tried to write with this degree of euphony and with this degree of invention, and it's fucking hard. Like, you can keep it up for a few paragraphs, but if you're inventing new stuff and it's good stuff and trying to get these beautiful phrases and this perfect euphony and this, like, the correct characterization for a long period of time, intensity is literally, you'd be fucking completely 100% focused on it, and it burns you out. When I read through this, I imagine Edison, maybe he was a man of superhuman energy. It sometimes seems from his biography that he might be. But you need to be, like, locked in like a fucking laser for the entirety of this book. It's like being watching it being etched in fire. When I consider the cognitive state he must have been in to have to create it. I guess it depends on how long it took him to make it, but even then it's like, it really is like focusing like the beams of the sun on a piece of like gem and then just etching it in. And every single, there's almost none of it that isn't like that. There's no like, there are things that you can argue they fail, and there are things that are perhaps imperfect, but there is no lacking it, no slipping away of the focus of the mind that created the book. It's all, he's there with you 100% all the time, kind of like a furnace behind the page, just lighting it up continuously.
It's essentially like he has that that horror vacui, that desire to intricately decorate every element so it is as beautiful, as pristine as possible. Reminds me of the symbolist painters who are essentially of that same era or of the era that precedes it, and characteristically have some of those elements, those fantastical medieval elements where, and everything is detailed and ornate and beautiful. Like Klimt is a classic symbolist.
I remember watching, was it Kenneth Clark in his Civilization series? He talked about like, what was it? He was describing medieval art, and it was like this great intense, this overflowing of like line and form and just like life, animation, density. And one thing I should mention is that from writing, one of the people who most like Edison in his great adornment of language is Spencer, but Edison chooses better scenes than Spencer, and he can do dramaturgy and he can do character better than Spencer. And so even though, like in most poets who write this well with adornments, there are kind of this boring bits where you're kind of reading for the adornment, and it's like, this isn't that good, but the list is fun, or this isn't that good, but the language is fun. In most cases, from my perspective, I know many people don't like this book, but for me, it isn't just like adorning an empty space or adorning a flawed scene. He chooses really good scenes, and which would be kind of interesting to read even with crap language, and then he adorns them, which is
absolutely,
I think, is excellent.
So characters, the characters, you would describe them in your review as being fairly, you know, they're fairly simple, 1 or 2 point characters with one very outstandingly nuanced character who is everyone's favorite, which is Lord Grow, formerly of Goblinland.
Yeah.
But also,
Brandon Dahl might be a favorite as well. But I think there's Manchian, like there's like Manning of Manchian. This isn't that because the people in it aren't super good or super evil. They're kind of largely good and largely evil, but more interesting. But it does have the massive polarity of a Manchian universe where these people are like always the heroes and these people are always the baddies, and that's just it. And in those universes and stories, there tends to be one person in the middle who ends up being more interesting, who kind of goes back and forth and who has like layers of complexity inside their character that other characters generally don't have as much of. And Gro is definitely that person. He's kind of the human, the tip of the spinning top as it bores into the earth, who's the person who feels and thinks all the things that the other characters cannot feel and think because they are glorious but terrible, like volcanoes of imagination before their people.
Volcanoes of imagination. Gro is intriguing. Gro is, I think that there is an element to which Gro is like Edison's adult response to the childish fantasy that sparked it all. In the original, this is in the original canon, which is the canon that comes from the child E.R. Edison. Gro was just another one of the characters engaged in all kinds of derring do, and a hero. But in this book, he does not really engage in any heroism at all. He is the perennial turncoat, changing from one side to the other as he favors the underdog each time. And there's a beautiful soliloquy in which he explains why he does this, in which he waxes lyrical about the beauty of evening, dawn and evening, and the garishness of noon. And
here it is. Day goeth up against the tyrant night. How delicate a spirit is she, how like a fawn she footeth it upon the mountains, pale, pitiful light matched with the primeval dark. But every sweet hovers in her battalions, and every heavenly influence cooleth of the wayward little winds of morning, flowers awakening, birds a carol, dews a sparkle on the fine drawn webs, the tiny spinners hang from fern frond to thorn, from thorn to wet dainty leaf of the silver birch. Young day laughing in her strength, wild with her own beauty, fire and life, and every scent and colour born anew to triumph over chaos and slow darkness and the kinless night. And then, but because day at her dawning hours have so bewitched me, must I yet love her when glutted with triumph she saddles to garish noon. Day and night as a female character, and Gro also, as much as he's in love with like the margins and changing courses, he's into women as well, women he can never get with, because if you read back, it seems that his changes of side often become through these mild infatuations with women who he's never going to end up with. I think Prismeria, when he changes from Goblinland to Witchland, and then the Lady Mivrian, who he doesn't change for, but she shames him in a remarkable scene. Then he bumps into her after hanging out with Satyrs, and he's like, do you want to get with me? She's like, no. He says, can I hang out with you? She's like, okay, you can hang out with me.
Okay. He had been thoroughly friend-zoned. So that's a fantastic part of the story, is the dramatic events leading up to Gro's defection from Witchland to Demonland because of the predatory sexuality of Corineus after he had, Corineus being essentially the grand strutting swaggering champion of Witchland.
Yes, the baddest of the bad. I guess the nastiest of the bad guys. You have like the high bad guy who's Garis, who's just magnificent. You have, I think, Corsus or Corund, I forget which is the best. One is like old and fat, and the other one is like the bad guy who's nearly good. He's like, oh, I'm bad, but I've got a sense of honor and I treat my men well. And then there's Corineus, who's just like sexually predatory, braggadocio, deeply, visibly, tangibly nasty. And whenever he turns up in the scene, I was reading this out loud to people, and they're like, oh, it's that guy. I even quailed for my own words when I was speaking his language. I was like, oh, he's doing this. Oh, he's bad, and he's creep, and he loves it.
He's also extraordinarily handsome and muscular, and the youngest and most potent in battle of the witches. Essentially, a counterpoint to Bran Doctor-Har, who is everyone's second favorite character in the story. Extraordinarily witty, a foppish kind of character, a dandy who is utterly, utterly deadly, the most dangerous swordsman in all the world. And Corineus is a beautiful counterpoint to him in that he is...
Yes, and Bran Doctor-Har, his intro is very, very femme. He's kind of it describes him as being like a girl in many ways, very slender and very flush and rosy of cheek. And his doublet has flowers and thunderbolts on it. He's kind of wonderful, and he's also the second most psychologically complex character, even though you see less of it than with Gro. I always thought that his extreme levels of inutience and diffidence came from his relatively sane perception of the world. And there's a moment towards the end where one of the female characters is in a state of despair and has a poisoned cup. And we, the readers, realize she's going to try and commit suicide. And of the characters in the scene, Bran Doctor-Har seems to work it out faster than everybody else and tries to manipulate the cup out of her hand but fails. And he realizes it, I think, before anybody else realizes what's going on. And that intrigued me because it seemed to suggest a deeper awareness in his character of what was going on around him.
Often he's got the sort of hooded eyes, but there's something going on. He's aware of what's going on.
He seems to balance almost on the edge of nihilism, I think. He's kind of like a good Joker figure where he's kind of like, I'll do this crazy borderline self-destructive stuff and I'll get you into so much trouble, but I will stick around and help you get out of it. And I do care about you. And I'm like the worst problem you'll ever have, but I'm also the best. I think he has a conversation with his friend Juss while they nearly died from a manticore fight and like had to fall off a cliff. And it's just like, I can't believe I listened to you. You consistently get me into shit. And it's like, yeah, I know, but you'll probably keep listening because it's me.
Well, yeah. Edison's benchmark for why these characters should exist is because they're entertaining, and Bran Doctor-Har is nothing if not entertaining. He's actually, he and Gro are responsible for my favourite piece of dialogue in the entire story. And it's just after, towards the end, when Gro suggests that to overcome these witches, we might be able to trick them. Invite them in for some kind of diplomatic talks and then murder them at night. And
yes, he says, your greatest weapon is your reputation for always doing the right thing, and you should use it to do the wrong thing.
And this is what Bran Doctor-Har says. Very prettily conceived upon my soul, said Bran Doctor-Har. Might I advise thee? Thou'dst best not talk to Juss in this manner. Not now, I mean, while his mind's so bent on matters of weight and moment. Nor I should say it to my sister Meverin. Women will oft-times take in sad earnest such conceit, though it be but talk and discourse. With me, 'tis otherwise. I'm something of a philosopher myself, and thy jest ambleth with my humour very pleasantly. Thou art pleased to be merry, said Gro. Many ere now, as the event hath proved, rejected my wholesome counsels to their own great hurt. But Bran Doctor-Har said lightly, fear not, my lord Gro. we'll reject no honest reeds of so wise a counsellor as thou, but, and here was a light in the eye of him that made Grow startle, did any man with serious intent dare bid me do a dastard deed, he should have my sword through the dearest part of his body. So he lets him off. He lets him off.
Right.
Grow suggests that we murder someone and murder people in their sleep, and Brandok says, this is not the way we work here. We're heroic to a fault.
Yeah.
Well, to a terrifying fault, yeah. I would say the character will entertain, but I think entertainment is too small a word to use for the intended effect. I would say joy. I would say basically every single moment, every character has to bring you joy with their, going to get fancy, their inscape. If you're familiar with Gerard Manley Hopkins, they're like, their being inside has to be like fully and massively presented to you every single time they arrive. And it has to be like this overflowing emotion of like, I'm here, I'm doing this particular thing, this thing inside, which is what I am, is what I do. And I'm going to do it right now in front of you in the most remarkable way. And I'm going to do that every single time.
They're essentially, that's what makes them heroes. They're heroes, not just in the sense that they're the protagonists in a story, but they're heroes in that mythic sense of, they're an embodiment of heroism. They're an embodiment of extraordinary action. And this is what they do. There's another quote, which is beautiful. It's a brief one where Mivash is saying, hang on, eastward, said Mivash, always lead to the Maruna. None may go thither and die. But they laughed and answered him, do not too narrowly define our power, sweet Mivash, restraining it to thy capacities. Know that our journey is a matter determined of, and it is fixed with nails of diamond to the wall of inevitable necessity. So they're fairly resolved to do this thing.
And I'd like to talk about the diamonds with Mivash for a while, because I found them, I'm always entertained by them and I enjoyed being around them, but I found them more tangibly unpleasant around Mivash than I ever did anywhere else. I think they were manageable amongst themselves, where they could boast amongst themselves. And they're always fun against their mortal enemies, the witches, where they can declaim against each other. But with Mivash, they were with someone who is more like a normal human being and who asked reasonable questions. And their responses, while magnificent, were kind of slightly, absolutely, oh, you're kind of intolerable to be around. It would be if you were real people.
I think they're slightly abhorrent. Go on, sorry.
Right. And the way they treat Mivash is... Yeah, the way it, and also like the questionable 19th century racial dynamics from Mivash is like this kind of vaguely orientalized figure who's superstitious. Unlike our polytheism, you believe in these weird gods, and who has reasonable fears about you being eaten by an, who won't immediately ride an alligator because he's afraid of being eaten, and who genuinely helps them and actually saves their life on at least one occasion, and they wouldn't have survived without him, and who they consistently just completely ignore from that point on, like he's almost nothing to them.
Well, there's a theme there of the doings of the great are significant and entertaining and beautiful, and a lot of nameless people get killed. Some named people get killed, but it's almost like the deaths of the foot soldiers just provide this beautiful carnage of this backdrop of carnage against which the the costumed heroics of the protagonists they're framed in this backdrop of carnage.
Right. And I think Mivash is the only one of the few named spear carriers who is a victim to the egos of these giant characters who we actually know about to any degree. And so if we could read like the stories of all the other people who died in these wars, we might consider it rather a horror story and have
there's certainly It's all public domain, so a revisionist reboot would be marvelous. You could write things.
Oh no, I think Terry Pratchett. I'm not really interested in revisionism because I think Terry Pratchett has just done everything you need to do with that. And I grew up in the era of revisionists, people who had read stuff like this in like the 50s and 60s, and who were then writing like socially complex stuff that questioned terrorism in like the 90s, 80s, and noughties. And I grew up on that. And for me, I read the revisionist first. And then after I'd read them, I went back and read the original. So I don't want to write a revisionist fiction ever again. I've read it. I'm like, that was fine. It was good. I enjoyed it, but I'm done with that.
No, I feel similar. There is an element, there is a critique of the story that it is colonialist. It's essentially about these ruling cast of literally superior people, the witches and the demons especially, but the witches also are superior in almost every way. They're richer, they're more physically capable, they're more heroic than everyone else. And within those particular nations, the aristocracy is superior again. So there's essentially a repugnant, and as I've said before, a fascist element to this. But I cannot find fault in that. I think that there is a faithfulness to the original text of that Edison was influenced by. There's a faithfulness to the horror and the carnage that occurs in the sagas and in the Iliad and the Odyssey. All these things had repugnant elements.
Yeah, and but it's again, as with the Odyssey and the Iliad, it's hard to tell what the view of the author Croty Hans is, because many of the events that take place, when you're reading the Iliad and the Odyssey, you're thinking these people are terrible. But the creator or the bard seems to focus on the terrible events and to let you see them, and doesn't really tell you whether they're good or bad, and doesn't question the heroism of the main person. It's like, yeah, this happened. So Odysseus slaughtering the suitors is like, oh, that was, or slaughtering the women in the palace is like, that's horrible, but they don't break away from it. And his men gradually being frittered away and dying on his ridiculous, like, due to his ego largely and his schemes. You'd see that. And it's like, are we meant to hate Odysseus? When we're listening to this, what's the state of mind of the intended audience? Are they meant to be going, yay, Odysseus? Or are they meant to be in a dual state where they both recognize that he's a hero and recognize that he's horrible? Or is thinking he's horrible something that we read into it because we're in the modern world? It's very hard to grasp what the original effect was meant to be. As with Edison, he shows you these things. It's like, well, what do you think? He doesn't tell you, are you meant to just go with it and be like, or ignore the horror? Or is it you just leaving it there silently and letting us see it if we want to? What do you think Edison thought about his own book?
I really think, and this is something I've said to you before, but I really think that he is responding to the energy that he had as a child, to the enthusiasm he had as a child about these stories, and he is using his mature, extraordinary skill and capacity with language to articulate a lot of the feelings that he had as a child about these stories. And there is something mm-hmm. extraordinarily violent and barbarous about the imagination of adolescent boys. I can recall. it's still there.
Yes. Have you but there's a comic called Axe Cop, which is by a guy who basically, he was a comic creator, and he talked to his 6 to 12 year old brother about about his imagination, and they invented this character called Axe Cop. And his 6 year old brother, or 12 year old, would describe what Axe Cop. He was a cop who had an axe, and would describe his adventures. And they were just like the most relentlessly, ridiculously inventive, violent, deranged, world crossing, insane bricolages of character and event with super murders happening every other page. But done as an actual story, and the tonality of that was a lot like the Worm Erebros, with just . But less cleaned up, with the massive systemic invention, the terrible violence, the complete, almost complete immorality. Oh, and themes of friendship as well, which is one thing that it's the one emotion that adolescent boys can feel that's kind of slightly empathic. As you have your friends, and your friends either get hurt and you have to save them, or very commonly, in Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, they get captured and taken away, and you have to team up with your other friends and run around the playground really fast and go and get them, and then you're friends again when you get them back.
Absolutely. I that theme of friendship is really extraordinarily strong. The friendship between Juss and Brand Dr. Haar, and also their love for Goldroo Blusko, who is apparently, he was the main character of the stories that Edison was telling when he was an adolescent, but perhaps for whatever reason, he was removed in order to become essentially the princess that needed to be rescued, the archetypal story.
We should talk about women a little bit, because although Edison has more women than Tolkien, which isn't very difficult, He doesn't do any of like the post 60 stuff where they venture out onto the field, or well, Tolkien did that. So, but he does. They do get to do a lot of very good classical stuff of basically being in castles, conspiring against each other, bravely defying super rapey guys, kind of sitting in forests and being extremely poetic and deep, being like brave and interesting and kind of potent in a very high femme way. I'm guessing Lady Meverin. Who do you prefer out of the women in the book, Tom? Like.
Presmira is the greatest. I would say one of the greatest characters in the whole book. Presmira is a Pixielander, the sister of Lafarise, mm-hmm. and Lafarise was a prince of Pixieland, or perhaps the king. And she is the young wife of the hoary old battle axe, the grizzled veteran general of the Witchland army, Corrand, one of three characters in the Witchland aristocracy whose mm-hmm. names start with C-O-R, which initially I found slightly confusing. But, so Presmira ends up, she is a noble character in the Witchland court, and she is responsible with Gro for some of the most sophisticated dialogue about the goings on, and she's a beautiful character, and she ends up, as you alluded to before, suiciding at the end, being essentially the one part of the Witchland court that they really wanted to preserve, the demons really wanted to preserve, because she wasn't mm-hmm. a Witchlander, she wasn't a witch herself, she was a Pixielander, and yet she suicides.
And another complex character who soaks up the actual violence that takes place, because she loses, she isn't like super evil, super good. She loses her brother. She loses her husband, who is one of the few good Witchlanders. She loses everything that she cares about because of these heroes running around murdering everyone. And then in the end, she has this, she doesn't just commit suicide. She commits suicide in the most defiant fuck all of you way that you could possibly imagine. She has like a magnificent scene where the Witchlanders in that typical self-destructive way, kill each other. There's one cup of poison left. She kind of ambles through this field of dead men with the Demonlanders bursting and saying, "We've won the war." And she's like, "Well, well, well." And there's a big scene with the cup, and then she's like, "Oh, a cup of poison." And then she describes just to the Demonlanders just how terrible they are and how terrible the situation is. And now she gives zero fucks about any of them. And they're like, "No, come with us and live." And she's like, "No, eat a dick." And then just downs the poison and dies in like magnificent heroism. No one can stop her. It's kind of the one glorious suicide in the book.
Yes, and that there's a few little glimmers like that. That response from her that actually characterizes what they're doing as being terrible. They are terrible. What their vanity and their vaunting, vainglorious deeds and daring do have, they wreak such carnage in the world. And there are a few. I believe there's another one from Gro where he's essentially acting as the conscience, saying this may be beautiful and grand what's going on, but it is actually also terrible. And that particular scene, it's extraordinarily archetypal, and that just brings to mind pre-Raphaelite. Presmira herself is very much like that extraordinary, exquisitely adorned Victorian idea of the medieval noblewoman, this tall, glorious, exquisitely adorned, thoroughly noble and beautiful character that I think...
And suffering, yeah.
And suffering, extraordinary, yeah.
Yeah, and she's like, let me see, how many kinds of women are there? There's Presmira, who's the most human woman, who has capacities for manipulation, but is also kind of very brave and in her own way honourable. There's Queen Sophonosbia, who is just magically pure and comes from the sky. Yes, there's Lady Meverian, who's kind of like...
Galadriel. Yes, go on.
Meverian, who's kind of basically... what's the lady in Lord of the Rings? Like, doesn't pick up a sword, but she's extremely, like, defiant and strong, almost to the point of masculinity. Even though she acts... Well, she does dress up as a man at one point to escape from a trap. And even though she's very, like, strong, she's, like, insanely beautiful. And everyone who sees her is, like... wants to get with her, so she's continually threatened by men who are either like Corinne is trying to rape her. Other men who are trying to rescue her, but as soon as they rescue her, they're like, do you want to maybe get with me? And she's like, no.
Now, forget about that little element. One of the sons of Corinth, who has inherited some nobility. Yeah, there is in that lineage of Corinth, there is some nobility even within the thoroughly wicked Witchland court. Yes.
And that's, I think maybe Edison was just squicked out by Corineus as much as we were reading about him. And he was kind of like, that's enough of Corineus. And then his passive sense came up and was like, someone needs to pull this to end this. And that's one of Gro's big heroic scenes where his manipulations are kind of noble because he cleverly moves. He does like this game of human chess around the court and gets Corineus drunk and just hangs out with him and just basically plans the entire escape in his head over the course of several cups of wine and just arranges everyone for her to get away. And you kind of, that's a very good Gro scene where you kind of Absolutely. Really feel for him. So we've had a human woman, presumably we've had super magical Galadriel woman, the Queen of Nazbia, Mevrian, who's kind of slightly masculine or like very bold woman. Who have I missed out,
well,
Tom?
The other female characters would be Zenambria and Sreva, Lady Sreva, who is Corsus's daughter. And
Yes, the super like catty, manipulative. She's very fun, doesn't she?
Absolutely.
Yes, she's like the more sexually aggressive one.
Courtly intrigue. That's when the genre of the story switches into courtly intrigue. Very Shakespearean for a while, where they're trying to determine who will lead the army that is going to conquer Demonland in the absence of the heroes. When only the colossally bumbling Spitfire is left. So the
And that brings us into one of his Edison's interesting dramatic techniques, which is to basically bring things to a peak or to have these dramatic events happening, and sometimes he'll follow them straight away, but very often he'll just fuck off and have to some other part of the world, or he'll switch scenes and have the events either leading up to them or resulting from them described in this kind of Rashomon fashion, where he'll be like, and then a big battle happened, and then we'll kick to a court, someone will walk in and say, what news of the battle? And they'll say, well, interesting story, which I'll tell you over the course of an entire chapter. Or they'll be like, we need to decide who's going to run this battle for us. Well, I'm going to have another, we're going to have a number of scenes where we scheme and lie and drink each other to death. And he does this a lot, like even the big climactic battle of, you don't see the demons breaking into Witchland. You don't see Greece, the king, destroys himself with a super demon summoning, which you don't see. His tower explodes, and again, he has an illustration of it, but you don't get it. You're not there with him when it happens. You just kind of know it's going to happen because at that point he's completely screwed. Instead of that, we go to a poison scene inside the castle and then Prismeria's magnificent scene. So there's this continual like stepping away from moments of high drama, which I don't think Tolkien ever does.
It's almost like Edison doesn't really have the budget to show the battles, so he has them described. But there's a really beautiful I quite enjoyed the strange little switch off to the Demonlander foot soldier who described the great Battle of Crothering Side.
Yes, and wouldn't you just stab him if you were his dad, where he turns up and they're like, how about this battle that will decide the fate of our entire country, and if it went against us, we better like get our horse and run because we're about to be raped to murder. And he says, well, I was there and I saw the whole thing. And they're like, yeah. He says, I'll tell you about it. And they're like, yeah. I'll tell you about it from the beginning to the end. And he's like, he talks for like an hour. And at the end, he's like, and we won. And they're like, okay, thanks.
I love it.
But yeah, it makes everyone, these very inhuman characters are more human because instead of seeing them often at their point of greatest, I don't know, Siegfriedian or Wagnerian super murdering, we see them after or before it. And then even though they're very like driven, often unidirectional people, we see them doing human things with each other in relation to these great events.
Yes, yes. One of the other elements. So the history of the world of Mercury, as initially described to us, seems to be extraordinarily shallow. It seems to the only really significant events were those events that occurred in the lives of the protagonists. There's been enough time for there to have been 12 Grises reincarnated over and over again, apparently as a middle-aged man each time, but beyond that, essentially the earliest event that is ever referred to as occurring or regularly is the battle with the ghouls, which occurred 10 or 11 years ago.
Yes. And that's interesting because it makes it very clearly a pseudo-history, which is locked into this particular pattern of events. But whereas Tolkien would be like, okay, I'm doing a pseudo-history, that means we need to have the entire history back to the creation of the world. With Edison, it's like, no, there was a big battle with the ghouls, and the ghouls were super dangerous, and if you could have met them, I guess there would have been a great scene with them, but they're gone now, and everything's happening after that event.
Absolutely. That brings to mind the little essay, what it might be like to live in Viraconium. By what's his name, the author of the Viraconium series. What's his name?
Is it Harrison? I've got his book somewhere.
Yeah, M. John Harrison, one of those people whose first name is a letter. Yeah, essentially the essay what it might be like to live in Viraconium is about the fact that the story, the invented world, solely exists to tell this story. And essentially, beyond the bounds of this story, nothing really exists. And I think this is really characteristic of this story in particular.
And a really interesting difference with, like, Harrison is because how alienated he is. I always imagine Harrison, I think I referred to him as the chief flagellant of the SS Fantasy, where he's like in front and he's kind of whipping himself because he wanted to read a story with a goblin in it. But his, like, the feeling you get from his books is like the non-existence of his world beyond its boundaries of its story is almost like an aggressive comment that he doesn't like books being that. Whereas Edison, you get the sense, just loves it. I mean, he's completely fully engaged in it. And it's not like he hates fantasy. It's just like, I don't have the time.
Absolutely.
To do that.
Absolutely. It's character driven. It's not, it's about these characters and the daring do that they engage in. And everything else that occurs is just framing.
We have. Oh, Greece, we should talk about the Witchlanders and how bad they are and how well their badness is integrated and how ridiculous the Crown of Witchland is and whether that's a deliberate joke or not. Because the Crown of Witchland is a giant iron crab, which is specifically described as having its claws poking up, going like, woo! And it's bejazzled in gems. And every time someone sees this crown on Greece's head, they're like, oh, the Crown of Witchland. Oh, it's so serious. And Greece is like the most kind of Assyrian. He's kind of like he's like very much like an Assyrian or Sumerian like warrior king. He's like super tall, he's gaunt, he's got a weird like goatee beard. He can stare at people and he freaks so much by looking at them. Sometimes when someone gives him bad news, he's like quiet for like 10 minutes. Everyone just quietly shits themselves. When he tells people to do stuff, they always do it, and everyone's like quietly worried about what Greece is going to do. And all the time he's doing it, he's wearing like a cape of fucking viper skins or his summoning robe. And on top of him is this fucking crown, which, if you imagine it, looks like the stupidest thing you can possibly think of.
Absolutely.
Yes. Edison think it's a silly crown or not, or is he just as into it as the characters are?
I don't think so. I think the crabfish, I imagine it came off as seeming heroic at the time. The interesting thing is that there are in this story there are actually two Garaces. There's the first Garas, who is Garas the 11th, who is a wrestler.
Mm-hmm. He never says wrestling, just wrestling.
He has on the walls of his throne room the skulls and bones of 99 famous champions whom he has killed while wrestling. And Goldrey Blosko was going to be the 100th, but Goldrey Blosko is, of course, the most ferocious person in the world, apparently, and kills him while wrestling after.
And not just that, but they have a full-on anime, like the end of a sports movie scene where the Witchlanders are winning. Gro is like, hey, the coach is like, hey, calm down, we might not be able to win this one. And then I think the Witchlanders are not only winning, but they cheat. And then it's not the fact that they're winning, but the rage at the cheating that basically drives Goldrey Blosko to go full Super Saiyan and have like an anime head-popping warp spasm where he's like, rah! And then just takes him out in one blow.
And my one of my favorite little phrases from the book, which I always thought was the canary in the coal mine of ascetic restraint, which is, when Goldrey is angry, his eyes blaze like disastrous stars at midnight. And I think that if you enjoy that phrase as a descriptor of someone who is angry, then you're probably likely to enjoy the language in the book. But that's essentially, the scene is all about the dastard deed that was done, which is what differentiates the two. When Garais was going to be overcome, he instead of being overcome, sticks his nose up, he sticks his fingers up Goldry Blusko's nose and claws the inside of his nostrils, and that's what makes him angry, because it is a dastard deed. And dastardly is the absolute opposite of what the demons are. To be dastardly is the worst thing you could possibly be.
The Witchlanders always have to cheat, and they always have to be magnificently self-destructive. And so almost every plan they have, many of them succeed, and they perform them quite well, and then they completely fuck it up one way or another. There's a bit where they capture all of their enemies. Really early in the book, they capture the Demonlanders. It's like, story's over, cut to credits. And then someone's turning up at the castle, and it's like, all we have to do, it's almost a comedy scene, is like, not mention the guys we have tied up in our cellar.
That is definitely a comedy scene. I love that scene. I've just recently gone over it again. It's all about like the wine bibbing of the demons, these characters becoming more and more outrageously drunk. Two of them in particular, Corsus becoming humorously drunk and talking about the 17 several sorts of devils in the Impland, and and Carinius becoming furiously drunk and seeming to get away with things that he should not have been getting away with, starting to blab the secretist intelligence, which is how Lafarise describes it. And he has to scorn Lafarise and tell him that they have the demons, and that so that the story comes undone. Plan comes undone.
Let me see. Where is this? So flieth folly before wisdom, which is in wine, said the king. The night is young. Bring me botargos and caviar and toast. Drink, prince, the red Thramnian wine that is thick like honey, wooeth the soul to divine philosophy. So the Witchlanders are even the king, who's like the most badass guy there, they're all borderline alcoholics. There are multiple times, especially with Corsus, where them drinking too much just completely unknots everything that they do.
And here's another one of the themes. Within that banquet, there are a lot of lists of dishes. There are a lot of lists. And lists are one of the characteristic elements of this book. The style in which it is written has these lists that are about extraordinary abundance of strange and wonderful things. This is something that's very dear to my heart, and I enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, the lists come in. Let me see. The architecture, both the Demonlanders and the Witchlanders have beautiful courts with their very specific, incredible pillars and columns and particular stones and particular gems. And they have like a particular aesthetic, and that's listed. The clothes of the main characters come in with like intense lists when they arrive. There are feudal levy lists where it's like this magnificent army arrived, and then they list the entire levy and they give you the geography of the place through like the list of the marching people and their particular weapons and the characters. There's nature lists where people are wandering through nature, and it's like, and then they saw this particular brook, and these are surprisingly good. There's even sky lists, I think, briefly, when someone's contemplating like the night or the air, and he'll go through like a description of that. And again, if you're not big on this, probably a bad book to read, but it's the these are kind of like micro poems of almost pure sound, really, of just like just these rhythms of like tumbling. I think even though I was a big fan of them towards the end, they did get maybe a little bit too much for me occasionally. But yeah, these intersperse with like the text with like they give you information about what's happening. In particular, they describe the world, but they're kind of like the bits in Moby Dick that no one likes, where it's like adventure, adventure, adventure. Now I'm going to talk about whales, more about whales. Oh, and so it's like story, story, story.
Go on.
Yeah, me too.
I think it's all about autism to an extent. Umberto Eco's The Infinity of Lists, which is a beautiful book all about lists, especially about really focuses on this early modern period, where there was the use of the Wunderkammern, cabinets of curiosity, which are essentially like ways of individuals, knowledgeable and wealthy individuals, to display their knowledge and power by having an extraordinary abundance of different things that show the diversity, the wonder of the world. And Umberto Eco uses this beautiful term, the poetics of etc., which is essentially a way of referring to the way lists, when they reach a certain, they reach this, the level of ad nauseum, where they're continuing to go on and on and on. They're referring to not just themselves, but to more. And so lists are essentially, to me, they're like a signpost that goes over the horizon. They're saying, these are all the wonderful things in a world, in a creation that contains all these wonderful things. There is obviously going to be more wonderful things. But yeah, this is just the et cetera is implied.
They're almost like chants when you read them aloud. What happens usually is that variety. So in turn, they're like, so firstly, it's a list. So the list suggests or necessitates that the things described must be of the same quality or of the same kind of things that you can put them in a list together. And so it's like there's enough of these things in this world to fill a list. And then there is the euphony of them. So none of the words are out of place and the flow of sound and compression moves like in this perfect rhythm through them. And then there is the invention of the things themselves. So it's like, which are all individually interesting on their own, usually in like a row of glistering gems. And then as you go through them, it's almost like a song, and it peaks at a point where it's like, we're going to keep going, we're going to keep going, we're going to keep going, we're going to keep going. And it dies away a little bit. And then usually at that point you end, and it just brings, it's like, yeah, you could break them out into like almost chants or as I said, micro poems. And they intersperse with like, so it's human scene, euphonic chant, human scene, euphonic chant, human scene, euphonic chant. Your mind on a larger scale is doing like humanity. I'm building people in my head. I understand the drama of it. These are, I feel like the livingness of it. And then there's like this dum 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 drum solo or guitar solo, which is less human, but just embroiders reality. And then you go back to human beings again.
That's a fascinating way of looking at it. It makes me think of the way in which the 1992 Francis Ford Coppola version of Dracula used, rather than having extravagant set design, they used costumes. And so it's sort of like the costumery in that was intense and intricate, and they used this as a shorthand for the intricacy, the beauty, the gothic decadence, all the elements that they're wanting to achieve that exist within the world. The costumery is like a way of referring to that. It's it's like a signpost referring to if the costumes are like this, then the world must be like this. So in this way, if the lists are like this, there is this diversity, this richness, this abundance in this world that you are expect to extrapolate from that.
A lot like cinema of the 50s and 60s when they developed color cameras, which were these big hefty things which made so much noise you had to put them in a special box. So the camera, which previously had flowed more, to be nailed down. And in the best films of the 50s, I think, stuff with Cary Grant in it, or early Bond films where you have the set design, they build these huge, magnificent, detailed sets, and people come into them and wend and wave their through these like palaces of like often upper class 50s or 60s people or supervillains, and it's like the camera's static, but you're just watching this person move through this kind of highly detailed, very beautiful and very like intensely imagined like a thing that you see from a single point of view. It's a lot like that.
That reminds me very much of the way Wes Anderson has his set design, and that sort of static way in which people move around within it. Yeah, that's extraordinarily true. So I'd like to just touch upon the historical context of the book, which is something we referred to very briefly. We referred to in the last, our previous aborted attempt. Actually, I just found out in my research that Ellison started to write this story in 1917, which I don't know if you are aware that there were things going on in the world in 1917 that were fairly significant. And
I had heard there was a bit of a fracas, yes.
I believe there was a fracas. And I can't help but think that there is some element of perhaps a reaction to that fracas, perhaps an escapist reaction, perhaps they're doing it all wrong. This is how it really should be done. This is how conflict should be done. But I think there is an element within the Wormley Roboros that is a response to the Great War. Perhaps
I think yes, but I think defining it purely as a scale, I think people writing in times of great social and turmoil and world change often do really interesting things. But I don't really, or sometimes you can call it escapism. I tend to think of it more as just basically the world puts enormous pressure on people and causes disorder inside them, and creative types do something in response to it, although what they do can be very different. So Mallory's in his cell in time of civil war, and he produces this like golden age of order. Tolkien is whacked out on pills from his gas attack, I think, and starts imagining werewolves in towers. And Edison is like, so the people create something. What they create, I don't think, is necessarily always best defined as escapism. And often they're very different to each other in the way that they often go back to their base. People go back to their basic emotions, and they're like, okay, world, social world has no meaning or less meaning.
Sure.
This vision of the world that we had before, it doesn't really work out. And then they do a kind of micro renaissance inside themselves, and they go, okay, let's go back to basics and let's start recreating everything from new. I think that's kind of what Edison is doing. Yeah.
Yes. So Tolkien, the first story that he actually wrote that became part of his later legendarium was written after the Battle of the Somme. While he was recovering, trench fever, I thought he had, but he might have been whacked down pain pills from a gas attack. And the story was The Fall of Gondolin, which is essentially the title gives the plot away. It's essentially about this most magnificent city of the elves, although they were called in a curious parallel to Edison here. They were called gnomes at that time. This is Galadriel's lineage, but at that time, the Gondolin was the city of the gnomes, but they were elves in every way that we understand Tolkien's elves. And Gondolin fell. Gondolin was attacked by Morgoth, Melko, and was destroyed utterly. At the time, interestingly, immediately after the Battle of the Somme, in which was the first example of tank warfare, the first version in this early draft of The Fall of Gondolin, part of the thing that destroyed Gondolin were these mechanical dragons of iron with orcs and balrogs inside them, and you know, they smashed down the walls and the disgorge. But essentially, the story is one of absolute defeat of the beauty in the world, of this most glorious city. And this is again part of Tolkien's theme throughout his life, the defeat of the beauty in the world. And essentially there is a response here that is very understandable given the historical nature of the Great War at the time. It's the end of the old world and the arrival of modernity in the most horrific way possible, the destruction of so much of the beauty of the world.
Yes.
But Edison responds in a slightly different way. So what is interesting?
Yes, well, basically, the worm robust to ruin it for everybody is both a magical thing, which is something that buggeries, it's worn in his ring, but at the end of the story, although the Witchlanders were self-destructive within the bounds of a single scene, it turns out that the Demonlanders and their super insane heroism, they defeat the Witchlanders, they have their home is freed, and they're sitting at home with their super magical queen that they found in the Himalayas. And she's like, hey, everything's great. You can go and be human now. And they're like, they're just looking around at each other with like heroin junkies who are coming down off a fix. And just does his wonderful scene where he brings his hot queen back to his house and shows her all. And there's a list of all the amazing stuff he's got. And she's very appreciative. And she's like, oh, look at your stuff. And he's like, yeah, I did these gardens. I did this. I've got these little minifigures, these monkai that I never got mentioned before, but I've got these guys. And she's like, you guys seem depressed. And they're like, yeah, life has no meaning for us because we don't have anything to do. And she's like, well, why don't you just do human things, like investigate the natural world? And like, okay. She's like, why don't you do like slightly nasty things? Why don't you go and imperialize the implanters? And they're like, it's too easy to imperialize the implanters. They're too subhuman to be fun being imperialist to them. And she's like, well, what do you want then? And they're like, we want the Witchlanders back. And they're like, going around, you remember how great the Witchlanders were? Remember that fight we had? Remember how great Corund was? Oh man, we missed Corund. Man, life is kind of pointless to us. And they're like, they give a beautiful, like another beautiful speech about, without them, our existence is pointless. And she's like, well, you're the heroes and I'm a magical queen and I can talk to the gods. And so I can ask them if they can bring the, are you sure you want me to do this? Because I can ask them to bring the Witchlanders back. Like, oh, really? And then there's a wonderful, like, pagan prayer scene where they go out and do a ritual, and then the sky fills with these meteorites, and like, there's a weird sign scene, and then they do, like, a scrying scene, and then they're like, what do you see? And she's like, I can see this guy, and she describes someone like Gro. And they, what else? I can see this guy, and she describes someone like Corund, and she's like, what about this guy? And they're like, it's the king of Witchland. They're like, can it be true they're back? And then it turns out that the gods, in appreciation for what Demons have done, have rewound time in some way. All of their villains and monsters have returned and sprung back into existence. Everything is exactly as it was at the beginning of the book, and then the first scene of the book repeats, where it's like, there's an ambassador for Witchland, which is what kicked off this particular part of the story. And this is entirely as part of a book and a story is kind of wonderful, and then was very unexpected to me because I wasn't expecting it to happen. But and then, so there are two different emotions to it. The book ends at that point, and you're kind of like, hey, this is fun. The Demonlanders get to do all the same things again. And then the Gro insiders, or the Prismarian insiders, is like, holy fuck, that's kind of messed up. Like, firstly, there's the Asperger sign, which is like, how does this work? Because you've rewound time for the baddies, not for the goodies. Are they just gonna repeat the same thing? So they have, are they gonna do things newly? Are they gonna deliberately not win the war this time and just fight and then lose so that they know they can keep fighting, which is kind of monstrous? And your adult side is kind of like, this is some crazy shit. These people are monsters trapped inside a bound dimension of their own creation. All they can do is repeat the same battles, which we know to be pointless because we've seen them happen. So this is kind of horrific, and all these emotions exist within you at the same time at the finish of the book. And that's why it's called The Worm Erebus. Edison has bound up the world of his childhood in this perfect loop so it can exist forever, and it's also kind of like dealt with, expressed, and separate to the rest of his self, I think. He's like, these are my emotions. Anyway, now we can relax.
Again, to me, it seems the perfect response to his childhood. He is right. It's almost like he's writing for young Eric, young Rick himself. The characters that he knew and loved got to do all of the wonderful things, but they're not going to stop doing all the wonderful things. This adventure is not over. We can go back to the beginning and start again. So yeah,
it's not over for them, but it's over for him. It's like he's dealing with the memory of his younger self. He's like, you're a pretty great guy, and I like you. I like the way you do things. I love the invention you've got. And then he's like, and I kind of, I'm going to let you go now, and you can just exist in the back of my memory as this spirit of who I was. And every so often I'll come and visit you, and it'll be cool. But you're not me now, and I don't hate you, and I think you might be kind of insane, but that's okay because you were like 12 or 15. I'm not going to worry too much about that. But I'm just going to, you're going to be a spirit within my gestalt now, and you are a memory. It doesn't, like, it's interesting that men tend to have, especially nerdy men, have really complex relationships with our own childhood, where we're either obsessively reliving them, and like, or some people tend to have kind of a low degraded view of their own, like, nerdy pursuits, where it's like, oh, I'm such a nerd. And you get this with journalists a lot, where it's like, oh yeah, the Warhammer nerds or the D&D nerds are like, yeah, they're so like misogynist and horrible, or whatever it is that you, that bothers you about your own inner self, tends to get expressed in your relationship with the memory of your own childhood, where you're kind of like, God, you were kind of, I either hate you or I love you. Whereas Edison's kind of like, deep breath, bit of meditation, man, that was great. And then it just kind of like eases you out of it. It's like, we are done now. We can go off to be something else. We can be like whatever Edison became, which apparently was pretty good. He seems to have been a pretty great guy in his lived experience, I think. And it isn't Tolkien's fallen world where it's like, oh, the Catholic tragedy. Oh, perfection must die. And it isn't like fascism where it's like, mein Herr, we are going to bring back the Demonlanders and kill everything on the planet. This glorious, crippled, super childhood. It's more like just a kind of a beautiful easing away of like a passing away of time.
Absolutely. And then he goes on later on to write the Zimian trilogy, which apparently they are tangentially connected. Zimianvia is referred to in the story. It's sort of beyond Kostra Bellon or Zoroark. It's a it's an afterlife associated with Mercury, I guess. And apparently Lessingham turns up, but I haven't read them. And by all accounts, they are inferior stories. This book stands by itself as being Edison's great work.
I'd haven't read them either, and perhaps if we had, we would have a different point of view, or maybe we would be the minority who are like, no, you don't understand Edison's genius. He was creating a new self. But it is hard. There are lots of writers who are really good in a particular character or mode. And there's a writer called, not Cordelia Smith, someone else, Tiptree, James Tiptree, who was also Alice Sheldon, who was someone who was kind of a woman writing as a man with complex gender awareness. And her stories, when she was pretending to be a guy, are really, really, really good. And it's generally believed that when she stopped pretending to be a guy, when she got found out or let it go, that the quality of her stories ebbed away. And it's difficult for people to tell whether they were, how they were related. But yeah, Edison let his childhood self go. We don't really know if he was, like, hopefully he was having a good time in his real life. But well, I guess one day we'll both read those stories and see if he was good or if he was different once he had surrendered his memories to us. Oh, gifted them to us, really. He didn't just let them go within himself. He handed them over to Revolves. He was like, hey, you can play in my sandbox.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. There are many other paracosms that are referred to. I find that of Henry Darger, the great outsider artist, in the early to mid part of the 20th century, there is some sense of there being some kind of similarities for all the strangenesses there, but he never was as mentally healthy and as capable and as extraordinarily talented a writer as Edison, nor were any of the other famous writers of paracosms, or nor did they actually go to this extent to do this. So it's essentially a unique kind of artifact as being an element of someone's childhood that has been captured by their adult self with all their adult capacities. So that's one of the things that makes it unique.
I think Steph Swainson's book Year of Our War isn't as good as The Woman with Bros in its particular qualities, but is good on its own terms. And that's also her dealing with the world she made when she was a schoolgirl. And she has a very Brand Dr. Hart hero who is like the kind of character, a 15-year-old girl event where he's like super sexy and is the only, he's like a crossbreed who no one understands who can also fly. And then he's like goes around being like a weird rock star in this fantasy world that's being eaten by insects. And that has the same kind of layering that Edison's does, where it has these very powerful childhood or adolescent myths and then they're reinvestigated or hers is more post-Pratchett, where she's genuinely trying to reinvestigate her own characters and kind of add, they're more characters, they have like adult depth, but that also is a very fun and also has a weird thing with immortality, because one of the central things in that is there's this strange emperor guy who turns up and decides he has the power to make people immortal. He's going to take people who are the best any particular fighty thing and make them immortals, and they will live forever until they are beaten at their particular fighty thing. So the best swordsman can live forever until someone's a better swordsman, and then they're kicked out. And the best shooting guy can be forever until someone outshoots him with an arrow, and then they get kicked out. And then that's kind of reinvestigated as like, oh, isn't this kind of dark and weird in a scary way? And isn't it kind of ruining society by keeping it trapped in this kind of weird neo-feudal obsession with just becoming immortal rather than doing anything useful? But that's kind of an interesting comparison to maybe to a child or an adolescent. The idea of being immortal, living forever, is a very different thing to the adult who's kind of like, oh, hold on now. It's a terrible aspect to it.
I can remember being a child. You assumed that somehow you lived forever. There was no notion of the of an end to this extraordinary adventure you were on at the time. So, yeah. Yes, so I believe we've covered the territory.
Yes, and we've wrapped up, I think. We've covered almost everything I want to talk about, and this is would be a reasonable place to end, and it's a neat time. That was our room. Like Edison, we are going to tie it in a knot and present it to you as a perfect whole.
And if you're interested in getting the full experience, you can just go back to the beginning of the podcast and listen again.
Yes, and read it again. Read it aloud. Don't just read it inside your head. Read it aloud, hopefully to someone else, and then you'll have the real Edison experience. Okay, goodbye, everybody. Thank you.